Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
John's doing just a tiny little bit more technical finding of things in the background here, so I'm just going to give a very quick introduction to him momentarily, but this is like one of those like fancy introductions where you talk all about somebody's like resume and personal characteristics before you actually invite them up to the stage. So we've been talking in contemporary issues about issues for faithful voters, right? And one of the issues that we all know is there is that people who disagree with each other have a really strong tendency to act like they don't like each other and don't trust each other, right? Where am I getting that, right? Yeah. Al's wrong and he's an idiot.
Yeah. I can argue with that.
So I'm going to claim without evidence that we do a poor job disagreeing with each other in this country, or of late anyway, have done a poor job disagreeing with each other in this country. And the good news is John Sproul thinks so too. And so John's going to be talking to us for the next, this week and next, about a book titled Love Your Enemies by Arthur Brooks. And Arthur Brooks is a conservative thinker, until recently head of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank. And one of Arthur Brooks' sort of primary talking points is that we have to understand each other. We have to be able to work together across political and ideological differences. He's written a book that he stole the title from Christianity. He's also Christian. Love Your Enemies, right? So we're going to look at not only, if I understand John correctly, not only or even primarily in the context of politics, but in the context of how do we deal with the fact that there are other human beings in the world? How do we deal with each other? So know that politics is there in the conversation. It's not the primary thing that we're talking about. Primarily what we're talking about is how to be good Christian people to other people. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
All right. I give you John Sproul.
Thank you. Now, you're going to give me back? I don't think they want me. Good morning.
Morning.
You see what I've got up there, and I think you can identify with that already. I've already had a couple people say, no, that's not possible, or words to that effect. But we can do better. As he said, the book is really about civility in politics or loving in politics or something like that. But I'm not going to talk much about politics. However, this is an audience participation seminar. So those of you who have questions or ideas, please put them out. I put, at any time, I put out pencils and paper. Actually, thank you, Mary did. And that way, if you have an idea, you can write it down, or there are a couple places where I might say, let's take a minute and make a list. So that's why you've got this stuff. Now, we've got Roger over here. Roger is everybody's favorite in class. He has read the assignment, apparently. He has read ahead. He has gotten all the materials, which is unlike the way I usually was in school. I remember to get to the right classroom for a 9 o'clock class. I was doing well. But Roger can particularly chime in. Okay. I also apologize in advance because I'm going to completely misunderstand or misrepresent about half of the Bible verses, I suspect. And there are at least two people in the room here who have degrees that say they can call me on that. So we'll see how it goes. But this is a paraphrase of a paraphrase, and I didn't quite make it all up myself, but most of it. Okay, can we go to slide 2, please? All right, that is the book cover, and he waved it at you, and he's got it in front of him. But I'm going to read you part of what I call the blurb from the inside of the front cover. Divisive politicians, hateful pundits, angry campus activists, Twitter trolls. Today in America, there is an outrage industrial complex that prospers by setting American against American, creating a culture of contempt. And that's what we're going to talk about, the culture of contempt, not the politics. If that comes in as an example, fine. But I'm not primarily focusing on politics. The habit of seeing people who disagree with us not as merely incorrect, but as worthless and defective. Maybe, like more than 9 out of 10 Americans, you dislike it, but hey, either you play along or you'll be left behind, right? Wrong. Okay, that's what the book is getting at. But I'm focusing on how we can get along with each other better every day in every way. Slide 3, please. I didn't get organized enough to put these in the right order. Now, exegesis. This is the only Greek word I think I'm going to use. Exegesis is not what I'm trying to do. I'm going to have some Bible quotes in here. And there are a couple people who probably know the details far better than I. And I'm not going to try to explain the Bible. I am shamefacedly taking some quotes that seem to fit with what I'm saying. And you might agree. But it isn't quite proof texting, but it's almost. And exegesis, we can't read it from back there, but it basically is a critical explanation or interpretation of a text, particularly a religious text. Traditionally, the term was used primarily for work with the Bible. However, in modern usage, biblical exegesis is used for better specificity to distinguish it from any other broader critical text explanation. In other words, I'm copping out. But if any of you want to engage in exegesis, there will be a follow-up seminar over coffee after church. Slide 3, 13, please. Now, I said last week this is not going to be about agape love. It doesn't negate agape love. But agape is something else. It's what it says here. C.S. Lewis uses agape in the four loves to describe what he believes is the highest level of love known to humanity, a selfless love that is passionately committed to the well-being of others. This, what I'm talking about here, isn't so much a selfless love as a love for others, but with your own, with the idea of getting along with other people, which is certainly not selfless. It's practical. And this is all about being practical. Yeah, now we...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. They can read ahead. It's okay. Empathy is a word that I'm not going to use very much, maybe not at all, as I talk. But it is the idea of putting yourself in the other person's shoes. That is a foundation stone of mindfulness, of various Eastern teachings, and should be of ours. If nothing else, when somebody says, that politician is just a waste of skin, we're going to try to default to putting yourself in the other person's shoes and try to maybe, if not examine, at least why they think that, let's say, we're going to have Medicare for all no matter what. At least put yourself in Elizabeth Warren's shoes and say, okay, let's see what she's getting at. And let's talk about not the basic idea, and particularly not about her as a waste of skin, but about the way that we could think about this and what, if anything, we can get from her position. key questions. The Bible says, love your neighbor as yourself and love your enemy. It says it in 100 different places in 100 different ways. Forgiving is not enough. It is not a positive emotion. I forgive you for being a rotten so-and-so. That's not right. That's just not right. Not you personally, all of you. Forgive all of you. Respect for the other person is always the start, okay? He's agreeing with me. I like this guy. If you say, we disagree for good reasons or bad, I at least want us to come out of here respecting the other person, even if you can't find a way to respect their viewpoint, although I'm going to urge you to try to do that, but to respect the other person as a worthwhile human being in God's eyes and hopefully yours. Respect is always the start. The golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You should probably expect from someone else of yourself at least that which you would expect of someone else. If you think the other person is at least kind of trying to make a point that might be helpful in the greater scheme of things, at least you're going to look at them as saying, okay, I don't totally disrespect you or the horse you rode in on. However, here we go. Now I have some scriptures on loving those who might make it easy to make enemies. And over here is the bottom one. Yes. I brought my faithful assistant Igor here. Some of these will be quoted again. Some will be obvious. Most of them you know. John 13 says, a new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. We're talking about a way to love someone else by respecting, honoring them, trying to understand them. In Luke, but I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Now the last word is loaded, mistreat. You're mistreating me because you must think I'm an idiot. But don't think that way. Try to think of that person as trying to be useful. One of the best lessons I ever learned was from our friend Shelley, who worked for me. And computers and I have a so-so relationship, and I should apply some of these to me and computers. But Shelley would see me sitting there at my desk struggling to do something and probably getting red-faced and saying inappropriate things. And Shelley would say, no, John, the computer wants to work with you. You have to want to work with it. And apply that to people. She was certainly right about me and computers. You're better than computers. Romans. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Self-explanatory in my context. Corinthians. We work hard with our own hands. When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure. If somebody's trying to get over on you, remain calm. Try and meet them on their ground. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. This is from Romans again. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. And that's the part where we get to... No, really. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. And... Well, Kevin's already run away, but he was agreeing with me that that's maybe the hard part. Live at peace with everyone, as far as possible. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head, something my mother always used to tell me to do. The best way to get even is to outsmart them or outwit them or outthink them. So, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That's ultimately what I'm trying to do here. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing, because to this you are called, so that you may inherit a blessing. Sounds Old Testament, but it's really 1 Peter. Anyone who claims to be the light, be in the light, but hates his brother, is still in the darkness. Whoever loves his brother lives in the light, and there is nothing in him to make him stumble. To me, that means if somebody is crossing you, for lack of a better word, you can still love your brother without loving anything he or she has to say. There is nothing to make him stumble. God commands us to love everyone, including our enemies. So, let us now go to video one, please.
That is it. That's video one. Mm-hmm. Four. Oh, video one.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes. The value in giving people more
to
the other.
How do I get it to come up?
Yeah. America's being torn apart.
Oh, there it is. Awesome. Now
the problem isn't that we're too angry.
We need to get that to the other screen, which is probably over there. So just pick this window up.
Well, I was just going to minimize the PowerPoint and...
Will it do it? I'll minimize that one.
Here, let me check. I
absolutely love it.
No, I'll minimize that.
It just sucks.
So PowerPoint.
Okay, I'll tell you a story.
PowerPoint has the screen extended.
I'll tell you a story, literally out of school. When I was in German class, in high school, I had a teacher who was not a native speaker, but pretty doggone good.
Can't full screen him.
But I had a mother who was German and would not teach me German. Goes back to the days after World War I when she emigrated, yet didn't speak German. You spoke English. And she just wouldn't teach me. But I heard a lot of it, especially at family gatherings. So one day, Frau Bakens said, she was messing with probably a slide projector, said, "Diese verdammte Maschine." Anybody in here speak German? Yeah, what did I say? This damn machine. But since she did that repeatedly, I told my mother, "Mom, tell me how to say shame on you, Frau Bakens." So she taught me, and the next time Frau Bakens said that, I said to her, "Frau Bakens, verschäme Sie sich." And she broke up. And everybody else was going, "What?" But that was maybe a silly example of what I'm trying to say. If she's trying to make things heavy, make them a little lighter. Understand her position. To her, this was a major annoyance. Now, moving on, let's play the video.
America's being torn apart, but our problem isn't that we're too angry at each other. It's not that we disagree too much. It's not even incivility or intolerance. The heart of the problem is contempt. Our habit of treating people who disagree with us not just as wrong or misguided in their views, but as worthless. You've probably noticed this because we see contempt everywhere we look in public life, on TV, on social media, from public figures. It's probably affecting your life too. 1 in 6 Americans have stopped talking to close friends and family over politics. Contempt is making us miserable and keeping us from making progress as a society. How can we fight back? I'm Arthur Brooks. I'm the president of the American Enterprise Institute and the author of the new book, Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. I'm ready to fight back. And if you are too, this video will help you begin to see just how we can do that. Before we can fight the culture of contempt, we have to understand the problem. First of all, contempt isn't the same thing as anger. We often perceive anger as a destructive emotion, but it serves an important purpose. Think about the last time you were angry at someone. Maybe you got in a fight with a friend, or your spouse, or a colleague. Were you hoping to erase that person from your life? Of course not. You wanted that person to right whatever wrong they'd done you. That's what anger is supposed to do, help us resolve conflicts. Contempt is different. It involves anger, but it adds another emotional ingredient. Disgust. The result of combining these two feelings is akin to what happens when you pour ammonia into bleach. You get a dangerous, toxic compound. Because while anger says, "I care about this and want to fix our relationship," contempt says, You're beneath caring about. It leads to permanent enemies, and it harms our happiness and our health. A psychologist named John Gottman has spent 40 years studying marital reconciliation and is arguably the world's leading expert in what makes relationships work. In fact, he can sit down with a couple for just 1 hour, and after listening to them talking about the relationship, he can predict with 94% accuracy whether they will divorce within 3 years. What's the giveaway? Indicators of contempt. Sarcasm, sneering, hostile humor, especially eye-rolling. So contempt is clearly bad for marriages. But aren't there some people out there who deserve our contempt? There are some pretty bad ideas out there. But contempt is always the wrong response for two reasons. The first is that dismissing voices on the fringes leaves those voices unchallenged by people of goodwill and excludes the possibility of getting them to reconsider their views. The second reason to say no to contempt is that it's terrible for us as individuals. Experiencing contempt increases anxiety, depression, and jealousy. It harms our sleep quality, and it causes a comprehensive degradation of our immune systems. But this isn't just the case when you're treated with contempt. It's also the case when you treat others with contempt. So if contempt is so bad for us, what can we do to overcome its grip on our culture? To answer this question, I asked the wisest man I know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. His answer? Practice warm-heartedness. Now, that may sound soft or idealistic to you, but coming from the Dalai Lama, this is actually tough and bracing advice. You see, the Dalai Lama leads the Tibetan Buddhist people, who were driven into exile by the communist Chinese government when he was just a teenager. Nevertheless, he begins each day by praying that China's leaders lead a good and happy life. If the Dalai Lama can practice warm-heartedness in the face of persecution and exile, we can practice warm-heartedness toward people with whom we disagree right here at home. To get you started, here are a few practical suggestions that will help us fight contempt with warm-heartedness. Number one, follow the 5-to-1 rule. Offer 5 encouraging, positive comments for every 1 criticism, whether in person or on social media. You might be an outlier on Twitter or in your friend group, but you'll be a magnetic force for warm-heartedness. Number two, stand up for people who aren't in the room. Most of us don't have many friends on the other side these days, which makes it easier to trash the people who aren't around. But if you hear your friends who agree with you saying contemptuous things about the people you disagree with, speak up. Don't be a jerk about it, but gently defend the people who aren't represented. Number three, ask yourself who in your life you've treated with contempt, who you've mocked or dismissed when you disagree. Maybe it's a family member, maybe it's a colleague, but gather up some courage and apologize. It'll be scary, but it's the right thing to do, and I'll tell you what, it'll set your heart on fire. If we can say no to contempt and embrace warm-heartedness, our problems won't disappear overnight. But if we're willing to commit to a renewed national culture based in solidarity and love, we'll be happier people. And we can build a movement that will make America the country that we and the world need it to be. For more on how you can help fight the culture of contempt, grab a copy of Love Your Enemies, available for pre-order now, and visit www.arthurbrooks.com.
He stole some of my thunder. Oh, wait a minute. I'm stealing his.
America's being torn apart.
Oh. Yeah, okay. That's the second video. Thank you. He talked about polarization. Can we come up with a couple of examples outside politics where we are polarized?
To me, that's pretty easy. It's the Presbyterian denomination, for one.
Okay.
25, 30 years ago or so forth, the denomination was embroiled with the new study on love and sexuality.
And a little before that, we didn't want women preaching.
That's right. You know, and Presbyterians have always had a hard time with money and sex. I don't know what the problem is. but it always has. But... my wife Barbara and I, we had several people who were on the General Assembly's committee who was working up this study and printing it and so forth. And of course the names were known who were on this, and she got just tons, this friend of ours, tons of hate mail, you know. And then the denomination had Presbyteries have conversations about what was written in the report. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. My wife was sitting here, we had another woman there, and this woman got up and she said, "My husband has given me permission to speak today." And Barbara, I had to literally hold her down before she slugged this other woman. I, you know, but yeah, I mean, it was that bad. It was that bad. We were at odds. As far as I know, we're still at odds with homosexuality and so forth on down the line.
I think that's true, although it tends to be sub rosa anymore. But there are still, I remember a few years ago when our presbytery was debating gay marriage. I forget what they actually called
the debate.
It was called various things at various times,
yeah,
so we can't
but,
help you there.
Well, okay, but the overture is what I'm talking about. Yes. I was there for the debate where we finally said yes or no in our presbytery, and it was polite, but there were a lot of clear views expressed. But I think they followed this rule of love your enemy, even though that rotten son of a gun is going to hell.
Absolutely.
And the one that jumps to my mind is that anytime we see a black person, particularly a black kid, shot by the police under any circumstances, instant polarization. There'll be news interviews with how the police are all rotten and we've got to have a new America, starting with killing all the police. And the white folks saying, well, and I'm saying that advisedly, the white folks saying, well, if these black kids would just not be hoodlums, that's polarization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think if you just keep that in mind as you look around this morning's newspaper or whatever you hear this week, you're going to see that polarization, big and little, and not only on big political topics, but on little things. Even at the office, there are people who hate the boss and people who like the boss, and they're going to couch it in terms of the boss doesn't see that he's ruining the company. And the other part is going to say, he's the boss. He gets to do what he says. We got to follow. And besides, I think he's right. That's polarization. But if we turn that into polarized actions and speech, then we're falling into the trap. So how do we overcome polarization? Easier said than done. There are a couple of wrong approaches I can suggest. One is to ignore disagreements. Now, you can't fight every battle, and you shouldn't have to, and you shouldn't want to. But sometimes there are disagreements that have to be talked about. And whether in the office or in the news media, there's things on which we disagree, or in Presbyterian politics, as Roger said. Don't ignore the disagreements. Empathy, try to figure out where the other person is coming from. The other thing is that's tempting is to say, well, let's just disagree less. Can't we get along? Famous line from Rodney King.
Yeah,
good. Good idea. Great idea. Can't we get along? Well, we can get along at least civilly, but we can't just sweep all the disagreements under the rug. So, to achieve more unity, we have to disagree better. Smarter. Is disagreeing bad? No. We have to have more disagreements, the author says. I agree. You can look forward to them as opportunities for growth. I'm going into a Presbytery meeting, and I know there's going to be a fight over, I don't know, cutting the budget. Pick anything. And I know that Reverend Smith over there is going to say, we have to go collect
per capita.
Dues?
Per capita.
Per capita, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm glad there are smart people here. And some others who are going to say, if they're not paying them, we have to look at why. And everybody's right. We need the money, but we have to figure out why people don't want to pay the money. Look forward to those disagreements as opportunities for growth. Maybe I can understand why he's saying his congregation is screeching to not pay the money. Maybe I can understand why her congregation is saying, we got to have the money. Now, let's move to competition. It's everywhere. We can't get away from it. We shouldn't try. Competition is good in commerce, of course. I mean, that's whatever, even the most left-wing folks you're going to hear on TV say, competition is good. It's the American way, the American way. But is it good in discourse? Do we have to view his views as something with whom we have to disagree? Do I have to view myself as being in competition with her? No. Even if we can't find a common ground, our job is to try to understand each other. Competition promotes growth in ideas and broadens thinking. Repeating, promotes growth in ideas and broadens thinking. Some of you have heard my presentation on Buddhism and my constant reference to my daughter's mindfulness practice as part of her psychology practice. And she is the one who, at a minimum, is going to say, okay, get into the other person's mind, stop and think for a minute. And this is critical. If you write anything down, write in, think this week. But overreaction is just anathema to what we're trying to do. If we can think a little and say, why'd she say that? We're starting on this path to better thinking. Some guidelines for disagreement. And this will be on the test. No, there won't be a test. But if you want to write this down, I'm going to keep coming back to this. Never try to insult anyone into disagreement. If you weren't so doggone dumb, you'd understand what I'm saying. Well, now, what do you expect for a reaction from that? We could have that disagreement. I heard on the Catholic radio channel the other night, I heard some people not exactly debating transubstantiation, but someone saying, that can't make any sense, and transubstantiation is the nice word for the wine being blood and not wine. They can argue about this, and will. And they probably will until they settle this, which they're not going to, at least not in my lifetime. But that is something where people could, the insults can fly. How can you say that's blood? You drank some of it. It's not blood. Or let alone us Presbyterians, you're drinking the blood of Christ. How can you do that? Yeah, you can get angry over that, over quickly. Now, if you want to go beyond that, let's debate about whether Mary is eternally a virgin. Try that one on your Catholic friends. That'll spark a fight, at least with some of them. Number two guideline. Never assume the person's motive. My favorite example of that, and yes, this is in politics, is you wouldn't say that if you weren't a socialist. Leaving aside the fact that few people understand what a socialist really is, and there isn't agreement even among the smart people. You're assuming a motive. You're assuming that person is trying to get over on you and foist a system on you that is bad for you and the horse you rode in on, as well as me. Okay? Don't assume motives. That dulls your reasoning. You can't think, well, why would that person think that we should have Medicare for all? Or why would they think that the boss should be fired? Think about sports teams, okay? Team wins, everybody's cool, especially with the quarterback. Team loses, we got to get a new quarterback and fire the manager on the way out. Every week. And there are reasonable ways to disagree. Like, if the offensive line isn't doing anything, we should maybe train them or try somebody else. But they shouldn't all go to hell. It excuses us from thinking if we assume motives. Again, you don't stop and think, well, what could she mean by that? What could be on his mind? However disordered it may be, let me at least understand what it is. It leads to ad hominem arguments. Most of us know what that is, but the idea is that idea can't be any good because you're dumb. That's an ad hominem argument. And you see those, hear those all the time. You know, that cop who shot that kid was an evil person. The cop probably wasn't an evil person. May have been wrong, may have been confused, may have been misapplying policy, maybe not thinking straight, maybe frightened. But it isn't so much about the person. At least don't make it about the person. We hardly know each other when we talk about others' motives. How can we know their motives? We have to be assuming, except in rare cases where somebody says, let me take 5 minutes and explain my motives. That doesn't happen. Or the question then is, how do we get to know each other? And that's what this is all about. Working with other people on the basis of their thinking, not your thinking. Are you raising your hand, ma'am?
Yes.
Yes, no, speak.
You know, that's what it says, take 5 minutes to explain it, but maybe the other side of that coin is the other person isn't going to give you that 5 minutes.
That's possibly true. The obvious answer is, well, I'm going to ask you to explain it. Maybe you won't be able to, which might be a sign, but that's beside the point. But yeah, you're right. Most people won't say, well, I'm against busing, and let me give you 17 reasons with citations to academic studies. Doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. Everybody comes into every disagreement, every conversation with pre-adjudicated ideas. You already know where you're going, and most of us, when somebody is talking, are always thinking of ways to argue, especially in disagreements at home. If the kid says, I don't want to eat my peas, you're already on the six arguments why you have to eat your peas, starting with, I said so. Yeah. Maybe think about, is there an alternative? Could you eat half your peas? A Girl Scout bite, as we used to have it. Could I substitute beans next time? You know, think through ways to know each other. Use your values, and it's, you know, again, arguing over peas. My value is, I was told that I need to clean my plate. There are starving children in Botswana. Or, you need to grow up strong and healthy. Or, I said so. That's a value. Parents have to have some control. But use your values as a gift that allow you to think about your values. If your value is, kids have to clean their plate. That's just not arguable. That's a value. It's a value judgment if you say, eat your peas or no dessert. Now, maybe you have to do that anyway, but at least know why you're saying that. And if you use your values as a gift, you're gonna, if you start to understand your values, then you're going to maybe be able to say, okay, why do I think that? Was it because my mom told me there were starving children in Botswana? Maybe there aren't, and I'm not going to send them my peas anyway. There might be other ways to approach this. In the book, you know, any of you who buy the book, and by the way, he said it's coming out for publication. It's available at your local Barnes & Noble or online or wherever, and you might even get lucky and find a copy at Half Price Books. I was going to say Better World Books, but they're online. And by the way, if you don't get online and look for cheap books, do it. Books are expensive, but Better World Books is one of my favorites. But just Google cheap books online and you'll find 37 of them. Amazon will have the first six slots, but go on down. In the book, there is an example. No, actually, it's in one of the videos you're going to see. There is an example of two possible reactions. Let's say I don't know you from Adam, but even if I do, let's pretend I don't. Here, I want you to have a nice day. Have these flowers. Now, most people are going to react as he did and say, thank you, and look a bit bewildered. But what's the reaction going to be if I say, have a nice day and beat you with the flowers? I've still given you flowers, but it's a totally different way of looking at it. And if you're then you should think, why is he doing this? Now, he might just be psychologically disordered, but more likely he thinks that I've got an ulterior motive, or he thinks I insulted him last week in church or whatever. But use your values as a gift, and if you can get that in your mind, don't beat your friends up with flowers. That might stick. That's a good visual. So assuming motives neutralizes our values. And if your value is be kind, be understanding, and you assume he's just crazy, he's beating me with flowers, that's understandable, but maybe you can try to understand why I'm doing that, that I might be psychologically disordered, or I might have some beef with you that you could explore. Our thoughts come from our values all day in every way. We don't think about them. I don't think about it's my value to not have a second piece of cake. That's somewhere in my values that I got to eat healthy. But even something like that comes from your values. Everything is value-laden. Assuming somebody else's values, or even your own, robs them of content. They become meaningless. So, again, use your values as a help, not a weapon. Maybe that comes down to simply trying to understand, but that is what we're getting at in part. Could we go to slide 19, please? Okay. Everybody can read. I'm not going to read it to you. Or is there anybody for whom that's too far away? As far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Now, this, of course, is what Kevin said rightly. Boy, that's hard. And he's right. But if you walk into the day saying, I'm going to try to live at peace with you, by understanding your motives, your values, by taking 5 seconds to think about what just said to me. You know, you are the one who blah, 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 blah. Is he really talking to me? Is he confusing me with him? You know, just give it some bit of thought. Give it 5 seconds before you react, which is not to say overreact, which is what I'm saying. Live at peace with possible is a matter of applying these thoughts, which is hard to do all the time, but we can work at it. Contempt. Think about some definitions of contempt, or synonyms, I should say. Anyone? How about dislike? Disrespect. Anger. You'll think of more, but contempt comes in a lot of, it's one word with a lot of different meanings. And then we have to move to, if you have contempt, you must be treating someone as an enemy, because you're having contempt for the person, not the idea, the person. So, what's an enemy? In something I read that I forgot to annotate, it says that your enemy, somewhere in the Old Testament, is a person with whom you have not chosen to speak for 3 days. Now, we do that. We all do that. Oh, at that last PTA meeting, she came up with the most ridiculous idea. I'm not going to talk to her. I don't think it's possible to have a civil conversation. That's contempt, and that's treating someone as an enemy. We don't need to have enemies. Nobody needs to be an enemy. Question: is contempt the opposite of respect? If I have nothing but contempt for your idea, can I still respect you why do I have to put you and your idea in the same chair and then beat you with the flowers? Think through that is contempt, the opposite of respect. So we talked about enemies. What do they look like? Give me some ideas of what enemies look like. Not in your heart of hearts, but in everyday thinking.
Somebody that doesn't think the way I do.
Hmm?
Somebody that doesn't think the way you do.
Somebody doesn't think the way I do.
The boss.
The boss. The crossing guard that says, no, you've got to wait. They've crossed you. But does that make them the enemy? No. We go around looking at people as if they are potential enemies, if not real enemies. You know, I've talked to him about this before, and I know he's going to disrespect me. See, I'm applying motives. He's going to disrespect me if I say that we need to love each other. And somebody's going to say, you can't do that. Now, if I know he's going to say that, that doesn't make him the enemy. That makes him somebody with whom I disagree. And it makes him someone who is not worthy of my contempt and disrespect. So, what do enemies look like? Same thing all the time. Are enemies automatic? Is the... To a black kid with a hoodie and a bag of Skittles, is that guy over there automatically an enemy? Could be. Not necessarily. Does your list of enemies change all the time, every day? You know, well, that grocery clerk put the eggs under the pumpkin. Now, I'm going to have disrespect for that idea, but I'll bet you the clerk is not such a bad human being. But if I decide, okay, at least in this moment when I'm cleaning up the mess, that guy is just an enemy. He's stupid. He shouldn't be hired for that job. Maybe he is stupid and shouldn't be hired for the job. But is your thinking that going to change anything? Ask yourself as we go, why are we assuming that somebody who does something that displeases you, whether for good reasons or bad, is an enemy? Try to think through, and closing statement, you can start to fold up your papers and, you know, shuffle around and think about what's going next. Why are we assuming that somebody is going to be the enemy? And think about that this week as you go through your week. Who, if you stop and think what's in your head, who might seem like they are or are going to be or could be an enemy? I'm going to start next time talking about Indians. I met, other than a couple of people I knew in college, I met the first batch of Indians I've ever met.
Are you talking about Native Americans?
Native Americans, yeah. Okay. Oh, interestingly, I tried to deal with the guy I was talking about as a Native American, and he said, call us Indians. We do. So, okay, they're Indians. But yes, Native Americans, you're right. We're going to talk about the Stockbridge Indians next. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Should this book be required reading for people in Washington on their sides of the aisle?
Wouldn't hurt. Yeah, now, you know, requiring... See, now here I'm almost assuming they're the enemy. If I'm going to say, if we assume that they're probably not going to read it anyway because they're already set in their opinions, I'm assuming their motives and making them an enemy.
What did you say?
I think probably they are.
What did you say we're going to talk about next week? Virginia?
The Stockbridge Indians.
Stockbridge Indians.
About which none of you except Pammy know anything. But it's a...
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.